I was constantly trying to grow my business. I didn't really care what my clients did. I just cared that they could pay me so that I could afford my rent. So it was like a constant hustle to get, just to get some sense of security in life. And the irony of it, looking back.
Welcome to the Ron Wheel Podcast. Are you dreaming of changing your life through opening a business? Or are you curious what obstacles entrepreneurs had to overcome on their journey? Then you're in the right place. My name is Agnes Billig and I'm your host. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Raw and Real. Today's guest on the show is Jeff Gibbard. You may know our speaker today as the world's most handsome social media and content marketing strategist, but what you may not know is that he's a real-life superhero. Jeff is also a sought-after strategist and speaker and the host of the popular podcast Charable. Hey Jeff, thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I love being on the other side of the microphone. It's nice. My job's easy now. You have to do the hard job.
Yeah, like that's something that I heard from other podcast hosts as well, right? And It's just so interesting to dive into someone's story who is also a good interviewer. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Cool. Yeah. Be forewarned, I may ask you some questions. It's just force of habit.
All right. So the first topic that I want to touch upon with you is, you know, you told me just a couple minutes ago that you have now a very comfortable life and you're not working as much as you used to before in the past. So can you tell us a little bit like what your journey was like and how you got to the point that you're have quite a chill life at the moment?
Yeah. So I came out of my MBA in 2008 and it was around the time social media was really taking off. I really chose that as the place to put all of my chips. So I went really hard into social media and content marketing. And I did that for about the last decade. Ran my own agency for 7 years, got acquired by a larger agency. And then after about a year and a half there, I dipped out. Took 6 months off to try and figure out what I want to be when I grow up. And in January 2020, I came out with kind of a whole new model, solo, no employees, nothing. And I deliberately looked back on everything that was really stressful about running an agency and working at an agency. And I said, I want something totally different. So I looked at my schedule almost as like a math problem. There's so many hours in a week. There's so many different things that I want to do. And I figured, how do I make it all fit? So before even having a single client, I laid out my ideal schedule and then I started to kind of backfill it. And I actually priced myself so that I could make a comfortable living for myself working that exact schedule. So I'm not trying to be a millionaire. I just need to be able to like cover my mortgage, have enough money to buy a PS5, and save some money for retirement. So I basically designed my schedule in reverse so that I could have the lifestyle that I want. And then I went about building that. It's not something I could have done early on because I didn't have any real brand recognition. My network was smaller. I probably couldn't have billed at as a higher rate as I can now because I don't think I would have been able to deliver enough value, but now I can. So I work 3 days a week now with clients, and then I have 1 day for planning, and then I take my Fridays off.
Wow, that sounds super nice. So how is it that at the moment, you know, you are able to do it this way? So like, what's your sales strategy that you get people to pay you so much kind of that you don't have to work as much?
Oh, there's so much we could go into with sales and positioning yourself and things like that. So I was having a conversation about this recently and I would argue that there's kind of like two things. So the first is you have to be good at what you do, obviously, because nobody's going to pay you to deliver subpar work. So I'm now at the point in my career where I have a lot of value to be able to provide, whether it's brand strategy, content strategy, social media strategy. I'm going to release a book on leadership in January 2022. I'm currently working on that with my publisher. So I have a lot of different skills and information that I can provide and value I can provide. So one, be good at what you do, obviously. And I think for young entrepreneurs, that's often tough because you want to come out of the gate and you want to be really like you want to make a lot of money and you want people to respect you, but like you kind of, it's not like it's not like you have to like pay your dues like unnecessarily. It's just more like you kind of have to put the reps in to get to the point where you're able to charge higher rates. And I've established myself as it's kind of an organic journey. You charge less money at some point, and then you just keep raising your prices and you play the supply and demand curve. If people are willing to pay you more money, it means you can keep pushing your prices for that time. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say is you have to have a differentiated brand. So I've never been shy. I've never been you know, the type to be a wallflower and blend into the background. Like, you meet me, you're going to remember me. So for the longest time, my LinkedIn headline was the world's most handsome social media and content marketing strategist. People remembered that. They took it with them everywhere they went. People that knew me would introduce me that way to other people. And it just, it made a major splash. So it was really helpful for having instantaneous recall for the people that would want to hire me or refer me. When I came out of the gate in January 2020, my new title, my new position, everything is about superheroes because I'm on a mission to save the world, basically. I want to help businesses who are out there to make a difference in people's lives. That's everything that I do comes back to being a superhero and changing the world. So having that strong positioning allows people to have an emotional connection to you and remember you more thoroughly. So if they can remember you, and obviously, hopefully they like you, if they know you and they like you, and you're good enough at what you do that they trust you, then you've got no like and trust. And that's kind of the winning formula over the years to really win at sales. So my sales strategy now is fielding incoming opportunities. I do very, very little outbound work because I put in 12 years of work of establishing who I am and what I'm about and what I'm good at and building a brand for myself.
So what were the things that you did in order to stay in people's minds besides having that tagline that obviously was different and made probably some people laugh?
Yeah, I've always hung my hat on generosity as being the critical cornerstone of how I do things. So when I go to a networking event with 100 people, I'm not interested in the 100 people. I'm interested in meeting one person and just making a really good relationship with them. So I play a very long game, and I play very slow and steady wins the race on this. I'm basically after building really deep relationships with people. And when I add someone to my network, they're relationships that I plan to keep, right? Like, so I'm not collecting business cards. I'm not collecting numbers. I'm collecting real relationships with real people that if I call, they would get back to me within 48 hours and vice versa. And a part of the reason why that works for me is that I am of a give first mentality. When somebody in my network needs something, like if I can make it fit, if I can make it happen, I will. I will do literally anything that I have the capacity to do in the time that I have available. If somebody needs a referral, I got them. If somebody needs an introduction, I got them. If somebody needs information, I've got resources or I've got referrals. So I'm always looking to help the people in my network. To the degree of like, I literally almost never ask for anything from anyone. And that's partly like a foolish pride thing. But I think one of the real keys to making good relationships in this world is being in service to others, caring about what happens to them, helping them grow, and doing whatever you can for them. And it gives you this sort of like bank of social capital that you store with people that hopefully you never have to make a withdrawal from. But if you do need to, you know that you've given enough that there's going to be some sense of reciprocity in them that they're going to want to help you out because you've given to them. So you don't do it because there's an expectation. You do it because you want to give, but understanding that underneath that, there's a certain benefit to it because when you need something, you're going to have people that look upon you favorably.
So when you go to a networking event, do you do a little bit of research about who that person is for you that you want to connect with and spend time with? Because when we talk about 100 people, you know, there are many different ones, and who's going to be the one that kind of is most beneficial to you?
Yeah, never, honestly. Like, it's because I never think about who could be most beneficial to me. I think about meeting interesting people. So, like, I don't care what somebody does, I care why they do it, I care what interests them about it, I cared what they want to be, what they wanted to be when they were a kid. I care about what they do in their time when they're not at work that just makes their heart light up. You know, like, so for that, there's no research I could do that. There's nothing in somebody's LinkedIn profile typically that I'm going to see on their job description that lets me know this is a person that is passionate about a thing, right? So I try to connect with people based upon what matters to them. So when I go into a networking event, I literally have no strategy at all. I just go, and I typically don't go to networking events, but when I do find myself in a networking scenario, I just want to talk to someone and connect with someone. And I don't even care who it is. The only way that I will leave like a conversation with somebody at a networking thing is if I sense that they are not genuine, if they're completely self-interested, if they are just going through the motions and don't have any real deep passions they're willing to explore or be vulnerable about. Like, I'm looking to make real deep human connections with people, not just, again, not just collect business cards, right? Like, I'm not trying to play a numbers game for any part of my life. Everything is about depth and quality. So when I go to a networking event, I'm looking for someone that I can keep in my world for functionally the rest of my life, unless one of us does something to, you know, dissolve the relationship.
Well, I'm curious, because now you're in a very, I would say, luxurious position, because you've already built your brand, you have a ton of experience, and like you mentioned before, you work 3 days a week, which is really nice. So how was it for you, for example, in the first 3 to 4 years when you started your business? Did you have the same mentality when you were going to networking events?
Oh, God, no, it was totally different. When I first started out, so I started my first company, actually, it wasn't my first company, but like this phase of my career, I guess. I started that in 2011. So for 2011 through 2018, it was all hustle and grind. I had a team that I was leading. I was constantly trying to grow my business. I didn't really care what my clients did. I just cared that they could pay me so that I could afford my rent. So it was like a constant hustle to get, just to get some sense of security in life. And the irony of it, looking back, is that in the beginning of your entrepreneurial journey, you take whatever comes your way. And to a certain extent, this is a good thing, because you'll learn what you want, what you don't. But you're worried about saying no to anything. You're worried about, you know, like turning down an opportunity because you need the money and all these sorts of things. You're worried about charging too much because someone might walk away. And like all of these were things that happened to me in my early career, is I just was hustling, trying to get any client that would take me on. Like, please, sir, can I have some money? But what I've noticed in this stage of my career is that the more rigid I become, the more almost inflexible about what I will and won't do, the more people respect me and are willing to play in the way that I do. So it used to be that I would say, whatever you need this, I can make that happen. You need that, I can make that happen. And now I'm like, here's what I do. I do these 5 things. You can hire me for these 5 things. If you need something else, I don't do that, right? You want me to discount my prices? I will not do that. I already have a list of people that want to work with me. I'm sorry, I can't give you a discount. So it part of it is that I'm now at the point where I have that freedom and some of that extra demand that I can make those decisions. But part of it is also by defining who I will and won't work with and what I will and won't do, I make it so that I repel the opportunities that waste my time, that aren't the type of work I want to do, or that are not profitable or whatever. And I instead narrow my scope to only working with a certain type of opportunity. So in the beginning, it was a grind. And now it's more like I pick and choose. And I think the mistake that a lot of entrepreneurs make is they think they have to wait to get to a point to pick and choose. Whereas what I would advise is the sooner you make the decision to pick and choose what you will and won't do, who you will and won't work with, what your brand is about, what your purpose is, the easier it then becomes, the faster you kind of get on the horse and on that, you know, on the path towards having the ideal life.
So I'm wondering, because like you said, that now you can pick and choose who you work with, right? But how was that when you didn't get as much inbound? Because now I guess you get a lot of requests organically, but that wasn't the case in the beginning. And then, okay, you can have certain standards of what you would like, right? But like you mentioned, you still got to pay your rent and you still need the money, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, so here's part of it is that even now, I have very, very rigid criteria, and I have things in my proposals that are designed specifically to repel the wrong clients. Like, I have an entire slide about my values, and I put them out there because I want people to know what those values are, right? So I have in my proposal, like, I believe Black Lives Matter. We are pro LGBTQ, pro immigrant. Like, it's all of my stances on things, because again, I'm a superhero. And I believe superheroes have certain values. So I put those in there because I want the people that see that and go, this guy, I want them to walk away because I don't want to work with them, right? So I put things in there specifically to repel people. Now, that said, if an opportunity comes in and I'm kind of on the fence about it, I don't really know if they're the right type of client or whatever, I still have the option to choose to take them. But I've defined exactly who I want, so that in my initial conversations helps people to kind of self-select themselves if they want to go further down the path. Whereas before, if it's too wide open, you get this sense that like, I'd assume that my buyers at that time got the sense like, what does this guy actually do? Does he just do whatever I say that I want because I'll pay him money? So it's sort of like the example I use with my coaching clients nowadays is I'll say, do you think that if you were to talk to Tony Robbins or Gary Vaynerchuk or any of these people, like, you know, their name, and you were to say to them, like, you know, could you do this? Like, could you do some graphic design work? They would be like, no. Do you know who I am? I do this. Well, can you lower your prices? No, I'm Tony Robbins, right? And I think the sooner you can adopt that posture of like, I'm Jeff Gibbard, and these are the things that I do, and this is what you hire me for. And if you need something else, like, I'm not interested in that because that doesn't align with what I'm about. So, but in the beginning, to your original question was like, you don't feel like you have that freedom, but I still think that it makes sense that the earlier you can define who you are, why you do what you do, what's important to you, who the right client is, what type of work you will and won't do, you still have the option to take on something else if you need the money. Like, I could still, you know, I say to my wife all the time, I'm never going to worry about $1,000. If it's $1,000 or less, like, I'll go and get a coaching client for like, you know, a session or two, and we'll make that $1,000. I'm not going to worry about it. But at that early point in my career, that was worrisome sometimes. Like, I needed $1,000 and I was like, where am I going to get it? And nobody knew me and nobody knew if I was good at a thing. So you do have to kind of, to my point earlier, you have to put in the reps so that people know you know what you're doing.
So can you share a little bit, what were the moments back then when you were really doubting yourself and how did you overcome them? Because I also heard you talking in one interview about the fact that you operate best when your back is against the wall.
Yeah. So I, you know, I think every entrepreneur, especially early, will have moments of, you know, kind of like crippling imposter syndrome of like, am I good enough at this? Can I even do this? Because I think what happens is if you're not making the money, you start to feel the pressure of rent and of bills and debt and all these things. And that, because it's a physical feeling in you almost, you begin to say, well, if I was any good at this, I wouldn't be experiencing this, right? Like, so we tie financial performance to aptitude when sometimes there's absolutely no connection between them. You could be really good at what you do and make no money, and you could be a complete fraud and make a lot of money, because the truth is people don't buy based on on your aptitude and how good you are at something. They base on how well you sell them on the idea of you being good at something. And I've seen plenty of snake oil sales. I worked in social media. I mean, that is an industry rampant with people who can talk a big talk but can't walk a big walk. So, you know, you experience these moments of fraud syndrome and doubt, and they feel crippling, right? What I have found either through instinct or through, you know, adopting this posture is that when I feel terrified, when I feel like I could lose everything, where I'm not going to be able to pay my rent and they're going to kick me out and I'm going to be homeless, that fear to some people is paralyzing. It just feels like, I don't know what to do. I can't do anything. Like, you just feel paralyzed with fear, right? Like, if I saw a great white shark, I'd be paralyzed with fear. Being up against the wall in terms of a thing that I have the power to effectuate an outcome towards. So like, I can do things to solve this. I am motivated at a level that nothing else motivates me. So what I've learned to do is actually manufacture that feeling. I create fear. Right now, I have a completely full client roster. Every single slot that could be bought is bought. All 3 days that I work, every client slot is purchased. I am basically still working for my clients as if every one of them is threatening to leave tomorrow. So it's a fuel for me to think everything could fall apart. I could lose everything I have. I could stop being able to pay my mortgage. I'll lose my house. My wife will leave me. Like, all of that runs in the, and it's not real. I know it's not real. But I still use it as if it's real to fuel me to work harder and harder and do better and better work.
Okay. So you feel like that drive to be better then somehow helps you to overcome these types of challenges?
Yeah. I mean, I I'm not filled with a lot of doubt in general. I am, for lack of a better term, I feel blessed that I am an extremely confident person. I believe that I can do things that I set my mind to. And partly it's because I have the evidence of it. I've failed at so many things and I'm still here. And actually, it's gotten better every single time I failed. I remember losing a client in 2014, and I thought that was it. Like, this is it. I'm out. I'm done. Nothing good will ever happen to me again. And I'm going to just quit, and I'm going to shut down the business. I'm going to go be a barista at Starbucks, and a bartender, and I'm going to go back to waiting tables, and that's that. And like, I had that happen. And after about a day or two of wallowing, I said, no, that's not how I go down. I'm going to fix this. So I went on like a hardcore business development binge, and I booked two clients within like 2 weeks. And it was for more money than I was currently making with that client that I lost. So again, like I use that fear to kind of fuel me through those periods of failure to get me back up the next thing. So it's like, if you think about yourself, like riding a mountain bike, right? And you're coming up on a big hill. It's a lot easier if you come off of the hill before with some momentum and try to fly up the hill using that momentum than if you start from a dead stop. I'm almost never at a dead stop. I try to use any failure or any doubt or any pessimism to drive me upwards into my optimism, into the next big win. And even if it doesn't work, I found that it always has a positive effect on the long term.
So what exactly happened with that client that you lost them? Like, what's the story behind it?
I mean, on the one hand, they were not a good fit client for me. Just personality-wise, there was a big clash. That was one piece. Another piece is I don't think that I did a very good job of sharing with them what I delivered. Like, we delivered work for them, but they had the sense like, oh no, we didn't do anything, right? And I think they had different expectations of what we agreed to. So we had an agreement in place of what we would deliver, and we delivered those things. And they had a different expectation of what those deliverables would be. So I learned a lot about like making sure that in your business development process, you're really crystal clear that the client knows exactly what they're getting from you. They know exactly what to expect in terms of the outcome. So like, I am almost a brutally harsh consultant and strategist for my clients, because I let them know chances are the first month of this campaign is going to be a complete disappointment to you. Nothing's going to happen from it. But on the other side, we're going to learn a lot from it, and we're going to be able to grow from that. And over the next 3 months, you'll be able to see a really, really positive return on investment. But you have to be patient for that, because that's the way these things work. So I'm very, very clear with clients about what's going to work, what's not going to work, how long it's going to take, and even if they don't want to hear that. So I think in this kind of to your point earlier about like some things that are different from then and now, I used to be very afraid to just speak truth directly to my client, to say the uncomfortable thing that would make them upset or that would cause them to doubt, because I was afraid if I said something that they didn't like, they would just fire me and then I wouldn't have my money to pay my rent and this and that. Now yeah. I know they respect in me is that I tell them things that they don't want to hear. And not for like the fun of disappointing them, but for like, I have an expertise in this. I know what's going to happen most likely in this. And that's why I'm telling it to you, because I want your expectations to be set right. And here's the plan for dealing with it. So I think that willingness to say what needs to be said is a majorly critical thing that I learned from, you know, the 2014 to now. When I lost that client, there was a lot. And quite honestly, I was very immature when I lost that client. I was angry at them. When we had phone calls, I was unprofessional. And there was a lot that I learned from that about myself and, you know, how I dealt with that moment of adversity and how I let my stress get to me and how I talked with people. And I've really tried to improve since then.
What did you change about your personal communications with clients then?
I mean, I think I better understand that losing your cool does not ever accomplish anything. And I also learned how to create the conditions so that I never have to lose my cool. So I document everything. I leave a paper trail for everything. Not because I want to have my clients in some sort of a gotcha sort of thing, but because I want there to be agreement about the reality of things that happened, right? So like, I'm very deliberate about my statements of work, my agreements. I'm very deliberate about when I deliver things, you know, and I give a client a strategy or things like that, when I walk them through and explain. I'm very deliberate about all of those pieces, because where I ran into trouble and where I think what was so upsetting there was that because I didn't have an airtight statement of work with that client that I lost, and because we didn't have, we weren't aligned on expectations, this client began to question my integrity, like me as a person, that maybe I was doing something to try and pull one over on them. And that is not something that I will ever allow for, because I operate my integrity is one of the most important things to me. I do things to make the world a better place. I care about people and want to actually help all of my clients grow and do great things. And I care about them as individuals, right? So to question my integrity about that was like a major affront to me. And it triggered me and made me act in a way that I wasn't comfortable with. So now, by being more deliberate on the sales side and on the front end of who I decide to work with, who I choose to work with, how I lay out my agreements, how I lay out my side, I avoid almost all of that. Because if we get through all of that and someone still decides to question my integrity, I can be like, I mean, if you look back at this entire paper trail, I mean, who's in the wrong here, buddy? So I've just been more deliberate about things. And I think getting more specific, being more vulnerable, getting on the same page and aligned with your clients, it just avoids a lot of that stuff.
That's a really good point. So another thing I wanted to dive into with you is that you wrote an article about the fact that all business is personal, as we're all human beings. So can you share your experiences related to that phrase?
Of course. So I'm toying with that as actually a tagline to my leadership book that's going to be coming out. So the book that I've written and that is currently being worked on with my editor is called The Lovable Leader. So it's a concept about leadership where essentially all business is personal. So the people that you work with, the customers that you interface with, the people that are above you in the org chart, the people that are below you, every single one of us is a human being. We have our jobs and our work and the things that are our accountabilities, but we also have, mental health issues. We have physical health issues. We have relationship issues. We have, maybe a pet died. We have times where we're feeling motivated, times we're not, times where we feel lost. We have experiences from our past that color how we look at things. And I think we often in business forget the fact that each person has all of this, that we're not just workers, like this rational actor worker, this imaginary figure that just shows up at work and has a to-do list and crosses things off from it. It doesn't work that way. Like, all human beings are emotional. All human beings are not entirely rational in the way that we act. And I believe that one of the problems with business is that we create the situation where we dehumanize people. So the phrase, it's not personal, it's just business, is an excuse that people use to not be empathetic and think about and care about other humans, right? So I've seen this. This happens a lot when you're firing someone, right? So or you have to make cuts of some sort, and you say, "Hey, it's not personal, it's business." Well, that doesn't really, it doesn't matter to the other person that it's just a business decision. That's irrelevant. They still think about their mortgage and their healthcare and how they're going to pay child support or whatever else they have going on in their unique life. That's what they're worried about. In the same way that when I was an entrepreneur, and many of the entrepreneurs that listen to your show, they think about like, how am I going to pay rent, right?
Yeah.
That's real to them. That's the real deal, their human situation. And I think when a business operates from that perspective of, let me think about the business first, it's not a good business. And it's not a particularly empathetic way to run your practice. You know what I'm saying? And I think the reason why that's so important to me is like, what is the point of all of this? If we really think about it, what is work? Work is just people doing stuff with people. We create markets. There are necessities, right? Like, there's food shopping and we need toilet paper and we need like doctors. Great. Necessities. These are things that are super important and they're necessities. We have markets for them. But then there's like all of the luxury items. Like, I'm dying to get a PS5 right now. Yeah. That's a luxury item, right? Like, for any decisions to be made around, luxury items that take people's humanity away and remove our ability to empathize with other people and think about their situation just because money and greed and growth for the sake of growth, I just think that it's immoral at its core. And that's just my perspective on it. And that's how I run my practice. I'm not saying that, because I believe that we're going to all of a sudden change what's wrong with capitalism, but that's just how I approach it.
How was it for you when you started running your business, also in the first 4 years, right? Because I bet a lot changed in that sense now.
Yeah, it absolutely has. The first 4 years were tough, but I grew every year. And it was just a lot of falling down and getting up and falling down and getting up, a lot of lessons learned. I definitely was more concerned with generating wealth and growing the business. I had this vision of growing like a big agency. Like I wanted 25, 30 person headcount. Then I wanted to grow to 100. And I had this whole like multinational social media agency thing in my head. And it's sort of like when I was 13, I thought I wanted to be a professional basketball player. It's like you have dreams at certain points in your life, and then you go through the process of chasing it and realize that that's not actually what you want. Maybe you actually don't have the commitment to do that, or maybe part of what it takes to do that is in conflict with your personal values. So, you know, I had to make a lot of decisions that like right now I just super not comfortable with from a business perspective. And that's why I decided that the way that I'm doing my work now is I'm a solo consultant and I sell my time to other agencies, to companies that want to hire me to be really good at what I do, but I don't want to have people working for me that I'm accountable for feeding them, because that creates a lot of stress and I never want what I do at work to harm another person. So I know that if I just have to be accountable for myself, then the worst thing will happen is I'm the one that gets harmed.
So you don't have any employees at all now?
Nope. And I have no plans to. That said, I do have a team. I have a lot of people that report to me and a lot of people that look to me for guidance and counsel across my different clients. So it's not like I lost the ability to be a leader or that I lost the ability to have a team and grow people. I lost the requirement and responsibility of having to meet payroll. And that's a whole different kind of strategy because payroll, you know, I have to make so much more money if I have people that I have to pay for. This way, I don't have to pay for any of them. My clients do. And I just have to pay for me.
So you don't work together with freelancers, or you don't like outsource stuff in general then? For sure, right?
I haven't yet. That's actually not true. I do occasionally hire a freelancer to do different things. Like I have a Stripe integration on the Superhero Institute. I don't know how to do that. I hired a freelancer off Fiverr. I needed a video intro, hire a freelancer, right? So I will use people in that sense. One of the kind of key distinctions around what I'm comfortable with and what I'm not comfortable with at this phase in my career is that I don't believe in labor exploitation, meaning let's say I wanted to hire you for something to like be a junior content strategist on my team. And I ask you how much you want to make and you say $75 an hour. And then I bill you to the client at $125 an hour.
Yeah.
I then take your $50 an hour and I pocket that. I don't like that. Okay. I know that that's like a great way to scale a business and I'm not shaming anyone for doing it. I'm not comfortable with it because I believe if your labor is worth $125 of value, that you should get $125. Why do I get 50 of your dollars for your work? I don't like that, right? So that's a very important piece. Now, a freelancer says, if I hired you as a freelancer, for instance, I'm not reselling your work or whatever, but I need you to create, five social media posts for me or something. And I ask you what it is and you say it's $75 and then I pay you $75. That's that. Like that's a market exchange of that's what your value is that you've determined. I determine whether I'm okay with that. If we make an agreement, then everything is fine. There's nothing about that that's shady. But if I then took your 5 graphics and I sold it to somebody else for $200, I feel like I just ripped you off for $125.
Okay, that's very interesting. I mean, it's really cool that you're that true to your values, right?
Yeah, so, and I can only do that because I'm a solo practice. If I had a company, the rules change. If I had 5, 10 people on my team, I have different obligations, which change my decision process. The reason I simplified everything to me as a solo actor is that it simplifies everything and I don't have complex decisions now. I can decide what I do and don't want to do and how much I'm willing to flex on those values, but it reduces the amount that I need to flex on those values.
Do you still have a last key takeaway, a personal insight that you would like to share that helped you grow?
I mean, I've said in the past, be all in on whatever it is that you're doing. So I do think that that's a very important one, but I don't think that's a good last key takeaway. I think
you don't believe in side hustles?
I don't. Well, no, that's not true. I do, but understand how they fit. And they have to be in service of your purpose, right? So I believe that everything should align around what you're trying to do. Understand why you work, I guess, is like the biggest thing. Like, why do you get up and do a thing at all? If it's for money, great. Like, make that your thing and let that guide your decisions. If it's because you want to see some sort of a change in the world, let that guide what you do, right? So like for me, I make money as a kind of side result of the mission that I'm on, as opposed to I make money because that's my thing and maybe I'll use the mission to get there. So it's about the order of operations, right? Like, you have to figure out why you work and then align everything around that. So all of my side hustles, for instance, they all fit. They all are neatly tucked under aligning towards the purpose that I have in my work. So I guess that might be it. If I had to give you the one key takeaway, though, I would say don't underestimate the importance of systems and processes to scale. Part of the reason why I got where I am, one of the biggest reasons, is when I started to focus on nailing down my systems and processes and getting more organized about how I do what I do. Because now every project that I do, I know exactly how I'm doing it. I have all the systems and processes in place. I know how I manage it. So I would say, outside of the purpose thing, which is the big lofty conversation, at a very tactical level, processes and systems are your pathway to scale.
And how can people get in touch with you?
Easiest way to get in touch with me is just to go to jeffgibbard.com. That's a place where you can find links to almost everything I do. Jeffgibbard.me is actually a listing of all of my projects. So on the side hustle thing, that's where you'll find all of my side hustles and everything I do. But jeffgibbard.com is where you'll be able to find me, connect with me. You'll be able to find links to the Superhero Institute. You'll see all of my content. You should definitely read my blog, subscribe to my podcast, check out all the stuff I do, because I think I'm pretty cool.
Thanks so much for sharing that. And for everyone who's watching or listening, we would love to hear from you. So what's your favorite insight from today? Please let us know in the comments below the video.
Thank you so much for listening. If you don't want to miss out on future episodes, please subscribe to the podcast on your preferred platform and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. And check out the show notes for a deeper dive on what you heard today.